Order for Wednesday, April 8th. And I'd like to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move LC 4174 be introduced as a committee measure.
Any discussion? Any objection? Understand this is just for the introduction of the committee measure, and committee members are free to vote no if they would like, unless they're my committee members. All right. Thank you.
Your disclaimer is much appreciated.
LCs are introduced. Close the work session.
I'll prepare a disclaimer for you.
Tyranny is alive and healthy.
With that, I'd like to open a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 927. Erin, will you describe the bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 927 modifies authority of Metropolitan Service District to acquire or construct visitor-oriented facilities. There's an emergency clause on this measure. It comes to you with a no revenue, no fiscal impact, and with 20 ayes and 10 no votes from your Senate.
With that, I would like to call up Tom Hughes, Andy Shaw, Joe Esmond, please. I apologize. I will be right back, but the committee will be here listening attentively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes. I'm the president of the Metro Council, the regional government in Portland, here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 927. 927 is actually an effort on our part to clarify language in the statute that is actually outdated. Language in the statute. It has been adjudicated and found to be no longer operative, but its existence there has created confusion that leads to lawsuits. And so the idea, part of the idea of this is to eliminate lawsuits. The context for bringing the bill to you is a public-private partnership in the Portland region to build a private convention center hotel. The hotel project brings new convention groups to the region, millions of dollars of tourist spending into Oregon, which will create new jobs and new state and local tax revenues. Metro plans to make an investment in the hotel by issuing revenue bonds to be repaid by taxes on the hotel visitors. The state has agreed to invest $10 million of lottery bond funding to the project. The hotel project has been fully vetted by the Metro Council, the Portland City Council, and Metro County Commissioners. Further, the hotel project has a deep backing by business and labor organizations, some of whom will testify in favor of it today. And it is long past time to complete this important economic development project. This bill is not centrally about the hotel project. The main idea of Senate Bill 927 is to clarify that Metro, in investing in this project, is acting under our voter-approved charter. More importantly, the bill makes it clear that dating back to the 1990s, the state does not intend to preempt the authority of local voter-approved charters, and a couple of legal actions recently have brought that into some question. We've had two lawsuits, or we have been party of two lawsuits at the local level that have raised the issue of whether we have the authority to do this under our charter, given the fact that statute says we don't. And in both cases, the lower court has said, yes, in fact, we do have that authority granted by our charter, and that the charter supersedes the state law in this particular case. Two different courts have understood that language, and we urge you to support Senate Bill 927, which simply clarifies that. With that, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from the whole panel first, please. Thank you.
Andy Shaw, Metro staff, really here to help answer questions, but we have submitted testimony from Metro's attorney that walks through the legal issues. Just the brief history, back in the 1960s, the legislature created the statutory authority to create metropolitan service districts. In the 90s, the voters of the state amended the Constitution to allow metropolitan service districts to establish a home rule charter. The metro area voters did that in 1993, established a home rule charter. The legislature followed that up in 1997, amending state law to sort of move out of the way of the home rule charter and make existing law subject to that charter. That is what this bill tries to clarify, that basically says a metropolitan service district that has a charter, these statutory requirements don't apply to. They would apply to a future metropolitan service district. If another region chose to establish one, the existing statutory scheme would apply to a non-chartered metropolitan service district. Metro is the only such district that exists today. So it doesn't get in the way of whatever the legislature's intent was back in the 1960s, but allows the voters who approved a charter to have the authorities they gave to their Metro Council honored. Happy to answer any questions if you have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative
Barnhart. You used the word such. My understanding is that Metro is chartered.
Yes, my point was the statute originally envisioned there could be other metropolitan service districts in the state. And what we're trying to distinguish here is between an MSD that has a charter that the voters have approved, that their authority derives from that charter, not from this statutory structure. A future MSD that was established would fall under the statutory provisions in existing law, unless they also voted to establish a home rule charter.
Thank you. That's what I thought you meant, but that wasn't quite what you said.
That is exactly what I meant. I'm sorry if I confused you.
Any other questions or comments for this panel? I'm sorry.
I don't have any questions,
though. Mr. Esmond.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent for the IBW Local 48, speaking this afternoon on behalf of the Columbia Pacific Building Trades, 15,000 members in the Portland, Vancouver area. We are in support of this 100%. We have an agreement with Mortenson Construction out of Idaho. It's going to be almost at all a letter of understanding about the hiring practices. Strong language for using apprentices and minorities from the community. Strong language about using local contractor vendors, suppliers, so everybody gets a little piece of the pie. Like some of you, I don't know about all of you, I go to a couple conventions a year around the country, and they all have a flagship hotel, and sometimes I stretch the truth with my boss and say, well, the conventions are a couple more days, and I get some time to go look around the countryside. And I think that's what's going to happen here. People will go to the coast and the mountains, wine country, Central Oregon, of course, and we are supportive of this. Just recently, the contractors group called SMACNA is the Sheet Metal Contractors Association. We're looking for a convention space around the country. They looked at here, with 4,000 people estimated to attend, and they couldn't have the hotel. So to me, like all of you and all of us want more jobs for Oregon, and I think this will be it will be one for us. So I urge your support. And if I start to, I'm a little tired. I spent 5 hours last night trying to get some more jobs bill passed in Portland. And hopefully you support the bill.
Great, any questions? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Question I would have, I'm just getting familiar with this and the numbers of this. And I see that, $120 million of the $200 million is by virtue of private investment. I was wondering why isn't the entire project funded in the private sector?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, we've done a lot of research over the years on convention center hotels. The nature of a headquarters hotel that supports a convention center includes a number of aspects that do not really pencil out for the average hotelier. So when the market itself looks at the potential of building a headquarters hotel, they tend to shy away from it. So there's virtually there are very few headquarters hotels in the United States that are constructed without some public involvement. There are examples of ones that where the public has borne the entire cost of building the hotel, that owns the hotel. We've sort of shied away from that. So what we think essentially we're buying in this hotel is a somewhat larger hotel than the market would put in that location. A hotel in that location, which is, for those of you who know Portland, is located across the river from downtown Portland. And other than the convention center, there isn't much there to attract a hotel. So we're getting great growth in the Portland hotel industry. All of it is across the river on the west side of the river near downtown or the Pearl District. And so we're as happens in most public-private cooperative adventures, we're trying to promote some things in the development of this hotel that the market wouldn't necessarily drive. The biggest one, by the way, finally, is that we are under contract with Hyatt. We have the ability to block the rooms. So 500 of those rooms we can block for conventions that are 3 years out, which is basically the time frame in which people book conventions. So we have the ability for Travel Portland, for example, who markets the convention center for us, to enter into an agreement with a potential convention to block 500 rooms at the headquarters hotel, and Hyatt will honor that commitment, that block commitment, and not rent those rooms out from under the convention. So that those three things are really incredibly valuable commodities that the market in and of itself would not drive. And so that's the reason for the private or for the public involvement in the process.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then, yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. The topic's been open, so I'll ask the next question. How is the public investment to be paid, or is it?
How is it to be paid off?
Yes.
Yes. The state has $10 million worth of bonds from the
lottery.
Brain went away there for a second. That the last session appropriated for this. Metro acquires a certain amount of money for a construction costs from the transit lodging tax already. And we'll put about $4 million of that to this project. Portland Development Commission, which has an urban renewal area in the area, will lend $4 million to the process. And then $60 million will be raised by selling revenue bonds, the revenue of which will be paid for by the transit lodging tax, primarily, and we think in most years, primarily by the transit, by the tax paid by the residents of this hotel. And so it essentially it almost resembles an urban renewal project in that the tax increment that we're creating by creating a new block of hotel rooms will pay off the revenue bonds that will support the hotel.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Esmond.
Very quickly, this has been planned for about since they first broke ground on the convention center. 93, 92.
I was still in high school. I think.
I was still an apprentice then, and so anyway, it's been in the plans. And I want to reassure Representative Barnhart that there will be EV charging stations in the facility.
I am very pleased to hear that.
Thank you.
One more vote you got. Okay. With that, I would like to call up Brian McCartan, and Mr. McCartan, I think it's sort of. Building off of Representative Wilson's question about, you know, why is there a private interest, I would really hope that you would address in your testimony, what is the public interest in this particular facility that would make it so that we, as the public, would want to help this happen?
Well, primarily I believe it is clearly in the jobs that will be created and the economic impact that will be showered throughout the region.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Brian McCartan, the Executive Vice President of Convention and Tourism Sales at Travel Portland, the entity whose responsibility it is to bring groups and conventions and visitors to Portland and in turn Oregon. The So to that point there, is the fact that all of the conventions and group business that does come to the Oregon Convention Center, does come to Portland, the amount of jobs that are created within the hospitality industry, and the billions of dollars of spending that are generated from those tourists just statewide as well, I think that would be clearly a big part of why. And why I believe that so many members of our board of directors and those in the hospitality industry are in favor of this key element of attracting more groups and conventions to Portland. You know, when organizations look at cities, they look at the basic package that their group requires. First and foremost on their list is a hotel adjacent to the convention center. It allows both key delegates and their all-important exhibitors to easily move between the convention center itself and then to further conduct business in smaller meeting space and hospitality suites that the hotel has adjacent. You know, Portland has attracted a very nice amount of convention business, but unfortunately we've lost more than our fair share as well, and that's why we've studied this issue for quite some time. Last year, Travel Portland booked conventions with over 143,000 hotel rooms associated with the Oregon Convention Center and over 260,000 more hotel rooms for all meetings in Portland. That represents $158 million in economic impact to businesses large and small. But last year we also lost over 64,000 hotel rooms worth $43 million in economic impact just last year due to the lack of an adjacent convention hotel. And we lost another 146,000 room nights with an economic impact of $110 million due to Portland's hotel package. In Portland, we have smaller hotels. So in a meeting with, say, a need of 1,700 rooms on their peak night of their convention, when they're looking at Portland, we have to ask them to be in five or six or more hotels, where in other cities they can host them in just two or three. So it's clearly easier to book another city, and we do hear that a lot. Just this week, Portland lost out on a convention that would have generated citywide economic impact of almost $13 million, just one convention, $13 million. The Microwave Theory and Techniques Society was looking at Portland for June of 2023. Over 15,000 hotel rooms would have been rented over the 9 days they would have been in town. All hotels, along with the restaurants, the retailers, and all of those in the industries, would have benefited from this terrific convention. However, our hotel package, again, lots of small hotels and no anchor hotel adjacent to the convention center, prevented us from competing for that convention. At Travel Portland, we're the organization that sees this happen all too often. In 2014, the central city of Portland had hotel occupancy of 80.2%. That's one of the top in the country. With an average daily rate of $160 and hotel revenue increases last year of 15.3% above the prior year. In this robust economy, existing hoteliers are not giving us the room blocks for conventions. They are betting on corporate business travel or leisure travelers, so meetings contracts are less attractive. We also know the convention business is a driver of regional and statewide tourism. Tom Drumhiller, who is a partner in Escape Lodging in Cannon Beach, and Jeff Constam at Timberline Lodge, both have shared how they know when a big convention is in Portland because it's felt in their region and around the state. Those delegates come earlier and stay later to see Oregon, and we at Travel Portland take that role very seriously. We find that often a meeting is the first driver of someone visiting Oregon, and after they've been here once, well, we know we've had them and they'll be back again. We host meeting planners. These are the individuals that decide whether a convention comes to a destination or not at Resort at the Mountain, Timberline, at events at Wine Country, Red Ridge Farms, and Ponzi Vineyards, for example. We actively sell our regional hotels and attractions. The Portland region and Oregon's economy and jobs are well served by tourism and conventions. The board of Travel Portland, as I mentioned earlier, has 11 hoteliers, 3 elected officials, and 14 hospitality partner members. They overwhelmingly support the convention hotel project because they know this will bring more economic impact and jobs to Portland, the region, and the state. Now is the time to build the hotel. Clearly, with the economy that we have and the circumstances, we can absorb these room nights more easily and grow the pie for everyone. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I want to thank you, and I know, you know, having worked in the outdoor industry, we had many conventions that we couldn't have come to Oregon, one of the greatest places for, you know, outdoor sports, because we didn't have a convention center the size enough. I know the International Association of Firefighters, the Oregon Firefighters Association, really wanted to have their convention here but could not because there wasn't a hotel that had the capacity to handle that level of convention. And I also know how much money, having worked in hotels, how much money is brought into a locality from that. So I want to thank you for your testimony and for your work. And with that, thank you very much. So is there any additional testimony on this bill from anyone who has not signed up? No? All right. We'll begin the work session, and I will accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move SB 927 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has, it said Gilliam, but I knew that wasn't right. Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved Senate Bill 927 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I am going to vote no, and the reason that I am primarily is because I am sick to death of hearing promises about what may happen for Southern Oregon and other poverty-ravaged places in Oregon. We keep being asked to do things for the metro area. I keep remonstrating about conditions in Southern Oregon, and none of my upstate colleagues ever vote to support anything that we need or refrain from doing anything that will hurt us. It just keeps coming our direction. So I see no vested interest in my constituents being for this, primarily because of the aforementioned things. You know, we're just getting sick to death about hearing about Portland and all the great things that need to happen in Portland, and we're hearing nothing, and I mean nothing, in the committees in this legislature. It is going to take a miracle to get any committee to do anything decent for Southern Oregon. And so I'm done with supporting things upstate. I'm not going to do it. And I'll be a most definite no vote on this.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And I do hope that when this, and I hope this bill will go through, and we build that hotel and get these conventions here, that we do a very good job of highlighting all the beauty in Southern Oregon so that we can get people down there visiting, spending their money, and seeing what a beautiful part of the state that you come from. And Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had not reviewed the bill before today. It is clear from the testimony and from the contents of the bill itself that it's a technical fix to conform the current statute to the Home Rule Charter that controls. It maintains the exact same requirements for any other metro that might be formed that is not chartered. And so the only change in the statute is a purely technical one that allows this statute to conform to the Home Rule Charter that the metro already has and that it's controlling in this case. I don't see any concern about it at all. I plan to vote in favor of it.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? With that, would you call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Kennebar?
No.
Representative McClain?
No.
Aye. Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Excused.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Chair Hoyle?
Decidedly yes. Mm-hmm. With that, the motion passes. And Representative Smith-Warner, would you like to carry the bill? Fantastic. I will close the public hearing and work session. With that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3500. Aaron, will you describe the measure? And I will be testifying on this, so I'm going to hand over. Hmm.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3500 provides primary ballot of all major parties to non-affiliated voters, permits non-affiliated voters to vote in primary election of major political party by submitting form stating the elector's intent to become an affiliated member of the party, and by returning form with completed primary ballot. The measure is to become operative January 1, 2016. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have no revenue impact. The fiscal impact statement has not yet been issued.
Colleagues, I want to thank you very much for hearing this bill today. This bill was filed to facilitate a conversation.
Sorry, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm Representative Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14 in beautiful Lane County, West Eugene and Junction City. Thank you very much.
You're beavers.
So, actually, a third of my district are beavers, and two-thirds are ducks, but you know, I believe we all can come together to vote for good legislation and have honest and good conversations like the one we're going to have today. This bill was filed to facilitate a conversation about how we can better engage non-affiliated voters in the primary election process and increase access to the ballot. What I heard in Measure 90, which went down decidedly in the last election cycle, and I did not support it. I did not support it because I didn't think in the form it was in, it actually engaged more people in the electoral process. And I talked to a lot of people about that. And what I heard was they didn't like the top two aspect of that of the primary in Measure 90, but they did feel like non-affiliated voters should have a voice and more of a voice. And when we have a third, and in some of our districts, 40% of the electorate that are non-affiliated, that's a lot of people that don't have a voice in the primary process. Now, I feel non-affiliated voters are different than people who belong to a party. For instance, a Democrat in Grants Pass is going to be very different than the majority of voters in that district, a Republican in Portland. But non-affiliated voters tend to be politics trend towards what the general district overall, the politics of the general district are. So I wanted to see if there was a way to increase their access to the ballot and do it in a format that was constitutional. So we looked through, working with NCSL, all of the states to see what they did to find a way that we could get non-affiliated voters to have a voice in primary elections. Now, I will say for the record, I think the best option would be for the parties to open up their primaries to non-affiliated voters. But you cannot force a party to open up their primary. So one of the things they do in New Hampshire, and it is different because we have vote by mail, is that they get around the constitutional issues by saying if you choose to vote and you get a choice, whether or not you want to vote the Republican ticket, the Democratic ticket, for us it would be the Independent Party ticket or Working Family Party ticket, you then become a member of that party. You can then, after that, go back to being non-affiliated. But I understand that there are complexities with that process, but it was a way to find, to start a conversation. I do not think that this bill will not go forward in this format. And what I would like to do is bring people who are affected by this to the table to have something come back in 2016. Now, in that conversation, I'd like to lay out my goals and values that I think we should adhere to. One is that non-affiliated voters should have more access to the primary election, have a voice in primary elections, because many important decisions are made in those primary elections. Two, when more people vote, democracy benefits. And so we don't want to cut out 40% of the voting population in our elections in deciding who goes forward in the general election. Three, our elections process should be simple, easy to access, and easy to use, which is why I think at the end of the day, having a universal ballot would be better than sending out all different kinds of ballots. But again, that's something to work out with the Secretary of State's office. And lastly, party membership is still meaningful, which is why I don't think a general open primary, where again, Democrats can vote in a Republican primary or Republicans can vote in a Democratic primary, I don't think that's the right way to go because again, party membership is meaningful. There are challenges. One is the constitutional barriers. We all took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and that of the state of Oregon, so we need to make sure that whatever we do is constitutional. And two, voters came back with a resounding no to the top two primaries. So the components of that I do not think should be part of this discussion. But again, out of the many, many people I talked to, they wanted us to find a way to give those people a voice. This is a start. So as you hear more testimony, what I would say is, let's not get caught up in the details of this bill, but rather let's use this as a starting point to engage in a conversation, a solutions-oriented conversation about how to give non-affiliated voters a larger voice in primary elections. I do want to say thank you to the county clerks. They do fantastic work, and they actually came forward with their concerns about cost, simplicity, transparency, and efficiency. And so I do want to highlight that I appreciate the way they've engaged in the process. I appreciate their communications. I appreciate their concerns. And as we move forward, I would definitely want their voices to be heard in any kind of solution that we come forward. What I would like to do is listen to what people have to say and have this bill amended to be a work group to come back with recommendations for 2016 and have the Secretary of State coordinate that work group.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Any questions for this panel? Representative McClain.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Representative Hoyle, a couple things. I didn't hear that we had a fiscal impact. Do we know what the fiscal impact is?
We haven't had a fiscal impact because I didn't intend to move this bill forward as it is, so we didn't ask. There would be a fiscal impact depending on how the Secretary of State would send out the ballots. For instance, if you were to send out one of each ballot, which I think would be very confusing, that would certainly add to the cost. But because this bill wasn't moving forward, this is just a public hearing, we didn't get the fiscal, nor do I intend to, because to be clear, I don't intend this bill to move, never intended this bill to move forward as written, but I do think it's an important conversation.
All right, thank you. And a follow-up, you mentioned about a working group to move a bill in 2016. That's being an election year. Are you willing to wait to 2017 so that we don't muddy the waters of the upcoming election?
I do not think that we should implement any kind of a new process before the 2016 election cycle. I agree with you. We've got enough things that we're adding, but I do think that we should move forward with some kind of proposal and a direction. But I agree with you that I think 2016 would be early for implementation.
I just wanted to make sure I heard that you said you agreed with me.
I did. It, you know, Representative.
Thank you.
Chair Smith-Warner, Representative McClain, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
I'm still going to take that as a compliment.
As you should.
Representative Wilson.
Madam Vice Chair, thank you. Really, about this proposal, again, we were told when we voted on Motor Voter that the check was in the mail, that once again impoverished counties would be saved from being drubbed one more time. And so I just want to say this for the record. If that check is in the mail, there'll be a subsequent check needed for this as well. And so I'm only hoping that if we move forward with this concept, whenever we move forward with this concept, that we'll remember once again it's an unfunded mandate to counties that are drowning in debt. And so we need to pay attention to that if we move forward. Thank you.
Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wilson, again, coming from a timber-dependent county, I do understand the need to ensure that we do not add burdens on our counties without providing the resources to manage the process. However, I will say that I will never do anything that decreases people's ability to vote. And if there's something that we can do that we should pay for, I think allowing people to participate in the democratic process throughout this great state is vitally important. But whereas we don't know what the process will be for engaging these voters, I don't know what that price tag would be. It could be minimal. But at the end of the day, if it means that more people have a voice on who represents them, then that's a price I'm willing to pay. Because what is the cost of democracy? What is the cost of democracy?
Representative Wilson.
Madam Vice Chair, I know all too well, being a past member of the military, what the price of democracy is. And so I don't need to be lectured on that. But you and I would have a fundamental disagreement from the get-go about barriers to voting in this state, where you have believed by your votes that we do have barriers to voting. I do not believe that we have barriers to voting. And so I also want that to be part of the record as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Smith-Warner and Representative Wilson. And thank you for your service. And I, too, coming from a timber-dependent county, and very, very cognizant of what we need to do to make sure that our counties can operate in a way that is that benefits the most people most efficiently. I also don't need to be lectured on the cost of something that we haven't even voted on yet. But I do appreciate you letting us know and reminding people that, yes, if we're going to vote on something, we do have to understand what that cost is. And I will keep that in mind. I always keep that in mind, and I do appreciate you bringing that up.
That's all I can ask. Thank you.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes, I remember you talking about this before the election season, how this was really important to you. So I think it's great that you're following through on the commitment and bring this here to the committee today. So I think that's fantastic. What I was actually curious is you referenced some of the other states and how they are progressing along. And I was curious how this affects party registration, you know, over the long term. And have there been any, if we looked at the satisfaction of the voters, I know, say, in an instant runoff type election, or, you know, where they rank the voting. I mean, there's, you know, a higher set of satisfaction amongst the voters. I was curious if any of that information had been gathered.
Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Rayfield, thank you for the question. And yes, I did talk to a number of people when I said I opposed Measure 90, but I did support increasing access to the ballot for non-affiliated voters. And I gave my word, and I feel very strongly that I should follow through on when I give my word, as do we all. But in other states, the difference is that they don't vote by mail. So say, for instance, in New Hampshire, when you show up at the ballot polling place, you can choose a ballot. That's difficult when it's vote by mail. So because we have a different process, it's different. I have talked to colleagues in Vermont where they have sort of an instant, they've done some instant runoff type of elections. And I'm not sure that it was as satisfactory or successful as I didn't get very good feedback, but it is not, has not been a scientific, we haven't scientifically looked at that. And what I would say is that we haven't had a comprehensive conversation with all interested parties at the table on how to solve these problems, but I do think that addressing some of those concerns and finding out information about what is the best process, what does result in the best voter satisfaction, what does result in the most people being engaged. I think those are all questions that would be great for a work group.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you so much. Okay. Okay, I'd like to close temporarily the public hearing on House Bill 3500 and open a hearing on House Bill 3397 and ask Representative Nathanson to come forward, please, while Aaron explains the bill.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3397 expands definition of political committee to include person that makes aggregate expenditures of $500 or more that refer to candidate, measure, or political party within 60 calendar days of primary or general election. This measure does have no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact statement has not yet been issued.
Representative Nathanson. Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. My chief co-sponsor in the House, Representative Davis, is in another hearing right now and can't join me here at the table, but I have shared these comments with him, and he joins me in the sentiments expressed in this statement. As an elected official and also as a voter in the state of Oregon, I'm concerned about a gap in financial disclosure in Oregon's political campaigns. As it stands, not all individuals and organizations that run informational ads, post signs, send mailers, and so on, before an election are required to report their spending. Most people think everyone's reporting, everyone is not. To be an informed voter, it's useful to know the source of information they are receiving or using. Voters expect that political campaign spending has been reported. They assume it. They think it all is. If an individual or an organization is spending more than $500 sending informational handouts, posting signs, or buying ads within 60 days before an election, voters would expect that this spending has been reported under existing campaign finance laws. But sometimes these communications are not reported, and no individual or organization is listed as the source. Knowing where campaign-related materials originate or how they're funded is vital to the democratic process. As Oregonians, we pride ourselves on transparency and disclosure in our campaigns. We don't have limits on what candidates can spend, but everyone knows how much is being spent, who's spending it, and where the money is coming from. My constituents are surprised to hear that this is actually not always true. Our civically engaged citizens and voters want to know and deserve this transparency. This bill, House Bill 3397, aims to close a loophole in Oregon's disclosure laws by requiring individuals and organizations that spend more than $500 publishing information on candidates within 60 days before an election to report their spending. It ensures a level playing field. It's pretty simple. It's just about establishing a level playing field. It's using existing law and existing reporting mechanisms to treat all campaign materials the same. You spend campaign money, you report it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Any questions? Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson, having just scanned the bill real quick, would this convert into disclosure the donors of a 501c4 that refers to a measure when the federal law does not require public disclosure of their donors?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, what we're doing is we're not trying to say you can't do this stuff, you just join the reporting that everyone else is doing.
May I follow up? Then let me just throw out a hypothetical so I fully understand what you intend this bill to do. If you had, for an example, a 501c4 or a c3 that doesn't have disclosure requirements, and let's say it's about hunting, it's in trying to encourage kids to hunt and fish, enjoy the outdoors. So and there's a bill on the a measure to ban the use of dogs to hunt cougars like we had 20 years ago. And if this group spent in a newspaper ad $1,000 for, let's say, various newspapers and said, oppose measure 1,000, or it says support measure 1,000, you know, 1,000, we believe in fair hunting. The effect of this bill would be to require them to disclose all their donors, or just the donors who gave the expenditure amount? Because, you know, C3s and C4s do a lot of things, and maybe, cougar hunting might be a very small, and $1,000 or $500 might be just a fraction of their expenditures. So I guess is, do you want to know all of their donors?
Madam
for $500
Chair.
On a measure.
And Madam Chair and Representative McLean, they would simply join the existing reporting rules. If it's an organization, the organization reports how much they spent as an organization, over $500. If an individual caused something to be published on a website or published in print or took out 10 billboards and caused that amount of money to be spent, the individual would report. But it just says that you fall under whatever the reporting rules are now. That's what the rules are. If there's an organization now that's spending money, it's reporting. For example, a political action committee would be filed, and a political action committee would report that they spent X amount of dollars on a particular activity.
Okay.
So the intent is to just extend existing reporting law to all electioneering or campaigning type expenses.
All right. If I might just follow up, I'm trying to understand, because I read some of this language as requiring disclosure of donors beyond that which is connected to the political expenditure. But I'll reread it. And perhaps if I'm still convinced that the bill may be overbroad, I'll bring it up with you.
And Madam Chair, if I might add one more thing. Representative Davis and I have spent some time discussing this bill and a couple of other bills with Department of Justice. And we understand that there have been constitutional concerns in the past about some bills or some proposals to try to bring the light of day or transparency to Oregon campaigns. We understand that there has been concern in the past. We believe that this proposal, because it's merely leveling the playing field and using existing law and existing reporting requirements, we believe that this proposal passes muster.
Yes, Representative Rayfield.
First and foremost, I love transparency, and so I like this, but I had a couple questions on, you know, when I was looking at the language, it actually only refers to a person and not an organization or corporations, and I don't know if that was intended to be, you said it was intended to be broader, or I don't know if there were going to be some amendments to address that, or that was my first question.
Madam Chair, there is an amendment, a dash two, that I'm not sure whether you don't have. It's in my file. We'll figure out how to get it to you. This amendment is just to clarify a few things, and it doesn't include that clarification, but I think there's something, it's elsewhere in the statute, because all we're doing is trying to make sure that all expenditures are covered. Existing definitions for individuals or organizations, whatever the definitions are in existing statute are the ones that hold. We don't try to make new definitions or new interpretations of law. We're trying to stick with existing statutes for defining an individual. And I'll have to try to read quickly here. I think it's covered somewhere else. I just need to find it.
the follow-up would be, and I'm curious about the two-month period or the 60-day period. To me, it would seem that I could make an expenditure 61 days from the date of an election with an express understanding that that entity that I'm making the expenditure to provide this service will provide it 2 weeks from the election day, 4 weeks from the election day. And so I was wondering why you chose 60 days.
Madam Chair and Representative Rayfield, we're trying to mimic some other existing law, not only state but federal rules. We're trying to keep this simple not only simple but attached to existing laws and existing rules that entities are already familiar with, rather than try to create something new. 60 days exists in other places, so we're just matching up with that.
My worry is that you'd still be able to get around it. Thank you.
Representative Kenmer.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward, and I know you put a lot of effort into it. And as you know, this is an area I have some interest in. Introduced a bill, and it's a remarkably complex issue. It seems pretty simple that you want people who are involved in the political process and spend money to be acknowledged as the spenders of the money. But when you get down to trying to figure out how to do that, and you have complications of corporate and this and that and how funds are solicited, it becomes a remarkably complicated process. And I guess what I applaud about this, and I think is wise, is maybe this is best done in some smaller steps. And that's why I think this is not as aggressive as I would like it or as many of us would like it. But you start and you see if that won't withstand the test, and then probably you come back and build on the base. And that's been sort of my thought about it. And I appreciate you bringing it forward. I just think the public deserves to know who's spending money trying to influence them.
And Representative Nathanson, you didn't mention this, but I will. What we saw in the last election cycle in Representative Nathanson's district was someone that put up websites and ads and signs and did not disclose who they were, said incredibly horribly offensive things that didn't go to, we can have political disagreements, and I think that's fair, but things that were actually untrue and highly offensive, but hid behind the fact that they didn't have to report who they were. And I think we can disagree and disagree strongly, and that's our job, but I don't think that that's an appropriate part of the political process. And I also, Representative Kenmer, want to applaud you, because for many years you've been working on ensuring that we do have transparency and we know who's influencing the political process.
Madam Chair, thank you for mentioning that campaign incident. It's unfortunate in my view, very unfortunate.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Representative Nathanson, I don't see anything on OLIS on any amendments. And so I think I'd love to see that, because, again, just looking at this language, a political committee, a person that makes aggregate expenditures of $500 or more that refer to a candidate, measure political party within 60 calendar days of a primary general election. Just another example, we have two actors in the legislature, Representatives Buckley and Gilliam. And I'm just throwing out a hypothetical, right? So what if the Shakespearean Festival is spending $1,000 advertising representative, come see Peter Buckley and Hamlet? And of course it has nothing to do, right, except it refers to a candidate. And so I have concerns that this language is going to lead to unintended consequences. And I could think of dozens of hypotheticals where it's included and it's in conflict with federal disclosure laws, and that's why I've been questioning so much. I'm not dissing your idea. I'm just trying to understand what you're trying to accomplish, and I think our language here is hard to to, and I'm sure Representative Buckley would be glad to be paid money to be in Hamlet.
Thank you. So there are a lot of concerns, but I think a lot of people acknowledge the problem, and I want to thank you and Representative Davis for taking a stab at it, and we look forward to seeing some amendments, and if anyone has concerns, bring them up with Representative Nathanson or Representative Davis. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing and reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3500. First, I would like to call up Dan Gilbert from Legislative Council to talk about some of the constitutional issues around this bill. As I had initially put this forward, it would not have required someone to become a member of another political party, but we had some constitutional issues with that. So before we have the larger discussion, could you want to identify yourself for the record and describe some of the constitutional issues?
Of course. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, and I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. The main constitutional issues with respect to a bill like HB 3500 come out of a 2001 U.S. Supreme Court case called the California Democratic Party versus Jones. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that states may not require political parties to allow non-affiliated voters to participate in the party's primary election. At the same time, the court recognized the legality of states granting voters the ability to change their political party affiliation up to and including on the date of the primary election, and it stated that doing so was qualitatively different from forcing political parties to allow non-affiliated voters to participate. With that as a background, the fact that Oregon has a vote by mail system raised a few fairly unique issues. And what HB 3500 tried to do was make it so that it would require the county clerk to mail the primary ballot for all major political parties to non-affiliated voters, and then voters would have the ability to vote in the primary election of one of these parties by declaring their by becoming affiliated with the major political party, filling out a form to do so, and also at the same time filling out the primary ballot.
Excuse me, is it limited to major?
It is limited to major, as major political parties are the only ones who the state pays for the ballots to go out. The potential issue with this, you know, on the one hand, you could argue that this would be legal under a current U.S. Supreme Court precedent, at least, saying that only members who commit to becoming members of the party could vote in that major party's primary election. On the other hand, it has some interesting aspects of it, just because when the non-affiliated voter would receive the ballots, they are non-affiliated, and they would receive ballots for those parties. And when they actually vote, they are still non-affiliated, as they wouldn't have been registered yet. So it's just an unanswered question in terms of which way a court may look at it, particularly given that Oregon has a broader free speech clause than the U.S. Constitution.
Perfect. Yes, Representative Rayfield.
Well, then the question becomes, when is a vote actually cast? So if I check my box and I keep it in my desk and I never return it to the county clerk, I haven't voted.
Correct.
Therefore, if they receive the ballot, actually mark the registration first, then count the vote, then the vote is counted and actually the ballot is cast at that moment.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Freyfeld, I think they're very, you could make a strong argument for that, but at the same time, it is different than if you went in person to a voting office, you said you want to become affiliated with a particular party, and you only receive that party's ballot, and then you vote there. And it's just a different process.
And Couldn't we simply modify the statute and define when a ballot is cast?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, maybe we could. I will just say that it is something that is not. There are limits to what we can define and how far courts will allow what we have defined. And it is just something like this, it is very possible that it would be litigated, and there's no case that I think is directly on point for it.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And with that, I will call up Dan Meeks, Sal Peralta.
I always have problems with these microphones. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dan Meek. I am co-chair of the Independent Party of Oregon, and with me is Sal Peralta, who is the secretary of the party. House Bill 3500 is a worthwhile idea, which could be made better and made more fair. Since it affords a convenient opportunity for voters, for unaffiliated voters to register with a major party, it actually comes in the ballot, with the ballot, it would seem fair to provide a equivalent opportunity for non-affiliated voters to join a minor party as well. So we suggest that there be a checkbox form so that the NAVs could also choose to join a minor party, not just a major party. Second, I of course debated many times the proponents of Measure 90 in the last election campaign, so I'm aware of their concerns. And I think that they were not looking for a more convenient way to register with a major party, which is basically what this bill would provide. What they were looking for was a way to influence the outcome of primary elections, major party primary elections, without actually joining a major party, which they many of them seem to have a philosophical objection to. So what the bill as written does, however, is that it compels anyone who wants to vote in the major party primary to join the major party. It compels party membership. And what we would suggest instead is to give each major party an option of allowing non-affiliated voters to return the ballot, return their primary ballot, and vote in that party's primary without joining the party. That is equivalent to what happens in 28 other states, which give major parties the option of allowing non-affiliated voters to vote in their primaries without joining the party. What the California Democratic Party versus Jones case in 2000 indicated in the Supreme Court, they said that it's unconstitutional to force or require a major party to allow NAVs to vote. But it didn't say anything about the laws in 28 states that allow major parties the option of allowing NAVs to vote without becoming members. And so we think that would be a good improvement. With that, I'll turn it over to Sal.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm the secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon. Before I begin my testimony, I just wanted to say how much I've appreciated hearing the deliberation here today. I've sat in many committee hearings and haven't heard it. Every process as deliberative as this one in terms of the question and answer, and I really appreciate that. To the bill. Some of the things that we like about the bill are that it provides an alternative opportunity for people to join political parties. And I think that's very important right now with the passage of the framework for the motor voter legislation. As most of you are probably aware, participation in political parties is declining in Oregon. Currently, 48% of all eligible voters, whether they're registered or not, are members of political parties. That's 60% of Oregonians are registered to vote who are eligible, and 80% of those people join political parties. Well, why do they join political parties? One reason is because it's rather easy to join a political party today. You go to the DMV hands you a voter registration card with the names of the political parties. You have an opportunity to vote, and you vote, or join the party, rather. Under Motor Voter, the DMV is no longer going to be providing the opportunity to join a political party at the point of sale. And so instead what we're doing is we're going to implement a direct mail system, essentially, where the DMV determines eligibility for the voter, adds them to a list. The Secretary of State then sends a letter to those voters inviting them to join a political party or to opt out of being a registered voter. Now, I would like to encourage the members of the committee to think for a moment about the number 48%. 48% of all eligible Oregonians are today members of political parties. How many of you, in order to hit that 48% number, that means that all new voters coming into the system are going to have a very high response rate for the letter to the letter from the Secretary of State inviting them an opportunity to vote. The Secretary of State's office did an invitation to people to register to vote prior to the last election period. 6,800 people out of 700,000 letters that went out availed themselves of that opportunity, according to their best guess.
Mr. Peralta, so are you talking about this bill or the voter bill?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I'm trying to set up the circumstances for why this bill matters. Okay. And the reason it matters is that I believe, as a percentage of the electorate, because of the new voters coming in, but also because now it's no longer as easy to register for a political party under the motor voter system, we're going to have not only more non-affiliated voters added to the system, but we're going to have a reduced actual number of people joining political parties, and I think that might be substantial over time. So this question is on point to the new framework that this legislature has adopted for registering to vote. We need to come up with alternate ways to get people to register as members of political parties if we care about the function of political parties. And what I think is going to happen is we're going to have a decreasing number of people participating in primary elections because fewer people are going to join any political party. So this subject is we're going to see increasing pressure over the next few years from the political parties themselves to say, hey, we need to get people registering. So I think that's one very good aspect to this bill. One of the things another aspect of the bill, of course, is allowing non-affiliated voters the opportunity to help select candidates for the November election. So what we did is we went to Representative Buehler and asked him to draft an amendment to this bill that would essentially keep the same system that we have today in Oregon, where Oregon allows political parties to allow non-affiliated voters to vote in their elections. But the implementation of that is broken because it's based on sending a card to voters. Some percentage of those voters return a card, and then that number of voters receives partisan primary ballot for the party that allows them to do that. So the Republican Party did this in 2012. And they sent out 450,000 cards to non-affiliated voters. 10,000 of them participated. If we could allow voters to receive the ballot and opt in at the time that they received the ballot, I think participation rates would increase significantly and simultaneously give people the opportunity to vote, register for any political party when they receive the ballot. So it's free voter registration for political parties, but not just limiting it to major political parties, making it available to all political parties. So we have an amendment drafted, we were expecting to have it for the hearing today, but we didn't get that. So we should have something for you in the next day or so from Legislative Council that we think addresses some of the challenges with this bill. We understand there's not an intention perhaps to move the legislation forward, but we will look forward to working with you in coalition to figure out how to how to crack this nut.
Thank you, Mr. Peralta, and I do agree, the members of this committee, this is a stellar committee, and they do, we are very deliberative, and I think we should have access, not for major parties, but minor parties as well. But the key thing is that whatever amendment come forward and whatever we do, it does need to be constitutional.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, yes, any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Your comments about the need to figure out how to manage party affiliation make a lot of sense to me. I think generally I agree with the logic of them. I'm interested. Can you describe for us, since we're in public hearing, what this amendment that you're talking about would actually do?
Yes. The gist of it, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, the gist of it was essentially to allow political parties to make their primaries available to non-affiliated voters, include the ballot for parties that opt into that system with the non-affiliated voters' ballot in the primary, and also include essentially a voter registration card with the ballot for non-affiliated voters, inviting them to join a political party of their choice. So it essentially just creates another voter registration opportunity, and also, in the case of political parties that open up their primaries, provides their ballot. That, in a nutshell, that's what it does.
Okay, so if I can understand, it sounds like it's this bill with one wrinkle, and that is that the political party would choose as to whether or not to open their primary.
Correct.
If they chose to, if the three major parties chose to open their primary, then presumably the non-affiliated voter would get three ballots from the political parties plus the regular ballot for non-affiliated voters for whatever issues are that everybody gets to vote on, and a registration card. And I think there's one other change that your proposal makes, if I understand it. Unless I've misunderstood, let me just make sure I've got it right. And that would be that returning the ballot returning the registration card would not be required in order for the ballot to be counted. Did I understand that correctly, even though you didn't actually say that?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, yes, that's correct. Although I would point out that under existing Oregon law, all three major political parties could choose to open their primaries. In that case, the Secretary of State would be obliged to send cards to all non-affiliated voters, notifying them of their opportunity to vote in those primaries. And for everybody who returned a card, would be obliged to return the ballots, to also send those ballots out with the cards as well. So that is not really all that different.
So this would just go in the same envelope.
That's
with,
right.
With the
there'd be no prior notice.
With the ballot that they returned.
Correct.
Okay. Were these amendments shared with the proponent with the sponsor of the bill?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, yes. As soon as we came up with the concept, I sent the concept to Representative Hoyle and then informed her of our intention of offering the amendments. But it was fairly late in the process because this bill had been pulled from consideration a few weeks ago, and we thought it was not likely to be heard.
And Mr. Peralta, by late, you mean yesterday?
Yeah, that's right.
Last night?
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, I look forward to seeing the amendment. I am interested and concerned about constitutional issues, but I certainly share the idea that political parties, if they're to have meaning in the future, need to make sure that people who are inclined to vote with them should also become members. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for testifying. Looking forward to working with you on this going forward. I would like to call up Les Poole and Rob Bavette. I know you're not testifying together, but I'm calling people up in twos.
That's all right. As long as he's registered with the right party, we're okay. My name is Les Poole. I live in Gladstone, and I've been active, well, politically for a long time. And the reason I've been active is that I'm informed and aware and I care. With all respect to what Chair Hoyle said at the beginning of this process, this is about starting a conversation. It's a strange way to start a conversation. And I believe the conversation that needs to be had is, why are people not registering to vote? Why are people not participating? Is it the parties that aren't identifying with them, or they're not feeling like it matters? We always hear it's apathy, but usually before apathy comes frustration. I remember the claims that vote by mail was going to make it so much easier and increase our participation because it was so difficult for folks to make it to the polls. I always felt that was a specious argument, and I'm not here to debate vote by mail, but here in Oregon we have vote by mail. You can register online. I can stop at any post office, right there in the post office, fill it out, put it in the mail. So the concept that people are not registering and somehow we need to steer them that way, it's troubling to me. And obviously the folks in this room are Democrats and Republicans. I'm referring to the committee. And the parties obviously were opposed to Measure 90, as I was. And this seems to be an attempt to take the Measure 90 message. And the message of 90 was, well, we need to get more participation in primaries. Well, I think the parties have work to do rather than the legislature on this. I think that's really the message you should be getting here. And it should be a strong message. I don't know how much money is spent every year by the parties on recruiting voters, and I'm all for that. I want people to participate. But those who don't register generally don't make good voters because they're not informed. So are we looking to lower the bar so that everyone votes, or they all vote a partisan way? I don't think that's what we're looking for, but I think that would be the final outcome. One of the earlier speakers mentioned how many people belong to political parties. I believe it was 48% in Oregon. Was that what we heard? Okay. Why do 52% not? I also see this as a confusing issue for people who are not registered to vote. If you're not affiliated and you're not sure what way to go, and you get these ballots coming in, or two, three ballots, right now we have three major parties, what happens to the unused ballots? What, is it up to the individual to destroy it? Do they have to sign off and mail it back? We are complicating a process. We're complicating something that really doesn't need fixing. And I'm completely opposed to this conversation and this concept. I really am, folks. And I'm really wondering, in a way, you know, are we really, in a roundabout way, going to force people to register with a party? Is that going to be the unintended or intended consequence of this effort? It's a question. I haven't thought about it, but it's obviously a question that we all need to be thinking about here. And with all of what I've heard about amendments and how to make this work and not interfering with 2016, we'll do it in 2017 so that the 2018 election is our test case. I don't think this deserves a test case, folks. I really don't. And I wonder what will happen if this concept moves forward, and in the end, somebody challenges legally and says, no, I want to remain unaffiliated. You're forcing me to join a party. Now the argument could legally be made, no, we're not doing that. And then ultimately this concept or what we're talking about here, we end up in court again. And I, as an Oregonian, am so tired of the legal costs and unintended consequences of things that come out of Salem. And this is one of them. There's no doubt in my mind that this is going to create more confusion, more legal challenges, and an unnecessary effort on your behalf. This is one of those bills that looks to be nothing more than something that could be gutted and stuffed and in the future. And frankly, if I had a choice and I was on this committee, I would say I want nothing to do with this, or let's find something worthwhile to stuff into this bill. That's how strongly I feel about this. We just passed what many people term forced registration with a motor voter bill. Obviously, it's not forced registration. So with a motor voter bill and with everything that's already been done with our election laws, it really is time to leave this alone. And I appreciate your time. I'm not here to offend anyone. We all have different sensibilities. But this is a road that this committee needs to take a change in direction on. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Mr. Poole, I very much appreciate your testimony. And certainly we will take your thoughts into consideration as we move forward. But thank you for coming here today.
Thanks.
Mr. Bavette.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The clerks, of course, are the administrators of the elections that we hold here in the state of Oregon. They're agnostic on the underlying concept. Their concerns are, as Dan from Legislative Council mentioned, that we do whatever we do is constitutional. And then secondarily, whatever we do is practical, that it doesn't create unnecessary burdens and unnecessary costs. And so we are very interested, as the chair mentioned, in being at the table when we have this discussion to make sure that we can avoid any unintended practical problems. The other thing I just mentioned to you briefly is we did submit some written testimony, as the chair mentioned, and on page 2 of that is basically just a list of what the other 49 states do. It's just a short list. Very interesting to me. I didn't realize how diverse these various states are in terms of how they structure their primaries and generals. I found Louisiana's to be kind of the most interesting, the so-called Cajun primary. Actually, it's so-called. That's what they call it.
Yeah.
So lots of different models we can look at. As Dan from Legislative Council mentioned, we are in kind of a unique situation because you're looking at some concepts that would apply to a state that is vote by mail. So there are additional things you need to take into consideration, and we are more than happy to participate in those work groups. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, both of you. And with that, finally, Joe Basler and Trent Lutz.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We represent 24,000 workers across the state, mostly public employees. And the reason why I'm testifying on this, I think, stems from our incredibly lengthy discussion we had on Measure 90 when our members were sort of debating it. I think it wasn't surprising, because I think a lot of different organizations had lengthy conversations about it. And I think for us, the principle behind it made a lot of sense. We have a growing number of NAVs within our own union. They often feel disenfranchised when it comes to being able to vote in the primary, and they wanted to know, well, why, Joe, why can't you fix that? And doesn't this fix it? So do something. So I'm here because I think what Representative Hoyle talked about in terms of putting together a task force, I think, is really important. I mean, we looked at Measure 90, and I think we opposed it, like most Oregonians did, based on a lot of, it seemed to be shifting the power to an election where less people voted. And that was very terrifying. I think also when, frankly, you have a large group of folks who are very wealthy telling you how to have run your democracy, you should be a little nervous. And so we sort of stayed away from it. I think the reason why we like the task force is so many folks have ideas on how to make our election system better. And, I mean, there was three measures filed in 2016 around the open primary. Maybe some of it was ballot title shopping, but it also included an instant runoff component in one of the measures. I think that shows that there's lots of different ideas on how to get at this problem. And I think for however many ideas there are, the only thing there's more of are ideas of why other people's ideas are bad. And so I think we really need to get folks together and have an open dialogue, push back. Because, you know, I know when I get an idea, I don't always maybe give full review of why it's bad. And I think it's important to have that sort of pushback in that discussion and sort of say, you know, what are the unintended consequences here? And so I think Representative Hoyle's suggestion of a task force makes the most sense. So.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, Trent Lutz representing the Oregon Education Association, representing 43,000, over 43,000 members across this state, mainly in the K through 12 community college and education service professionals. Coming here to support the concept of moving forward with the task force as well. The Oregon Education Association, our members, has always been proud to support opening up our process and making sure that we are actually encouraging and allowing more members, more people to vote. It's why we've supported things like the open or same-day voter registration in the past and other election bills that, like Motor Voter, that will give broader and more open access. I think that when it comes down to this, it's important that this discussion happens. So thank you for bringing this bill forward and opening up this discussion, because as the growing number of non-affiliated voters and are in the process, making sure that they have voice. Mm-hmm. I think that there's three key tenets that we're going to be looking at and hopefully as this work group and task force goes forward, was that number one, that this is an open, you know, that we should be trying to be bringing as many voices to the table as possible and actually hashing out what actually moves forward and making sure that we're trying to include as many voters' voices as possible to participate. And in that this process encourage engagement of the voters, that people will actually participate and actually partake in the primary system, and that we are actually encouraging voting and encouraging participation in the process. And number three is simplicity, is making sure that at the end of the day that we don't create a confusing process, but we create a process that is easy, that is accessible, and that allows non-affiliated voters to participate if possible through this. At the end of the day, we do believe that this has to be constitutional, that this has to be legal, and there are a number of ideas that have been put on the table. I think at the end of the day, coming together and hashing through those, it will end up in a good process. So I look forward to the conversation and hope to participate in any way we can.
Great. Questions, comments? Great. Thank you very much. With that, close the public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 3397. Would like to call up Dan Meek. And just you're the only one in support. Well, if you want to come up together, come on up. So we've got Dan Meek, Norman Turo. For right now, we'll just have you two. Mr. Meek.
Good afternoon again, Dan Meek. I submitted some testimony on this bill on behalf of the Progressive Party of Oregon. And while it's a good idea, I'm afraid it could be easily rendered ineffective by any political operative with a few months of experience. First of all, as I believe it was Representative Rayfield pointed out, this bill could be, the requirement to register as a political committee could be totally evaded simply by placing your ad by on the 61st day before the election, and then you don't have to report anything ever. That's certainly an easy enough thing to do. In addition, a second way it would be ineffective is it could be evaded by simply creating euphoniously named political committees, like the good. For example, I'm an independent spender. I have to register something, so I'm going to register the Good Things for Oregon Committee. And I don't identify the economic interests of the contributors. In fact, the contributor could be a 501c4, which doesn't identify its and ORSTAR doesn't require that the 501c4 identify its funders. So I would suggest that added to this should be the California law that requires that political committee names must reflect the interests of most of the funders. And this was the illustration is how this affected the outcome of the election in the city of Richmond in last year, when Chevron supported with millions of dollars a slate of its own candidates for mayor and city council in the city of Richmond, outspent the opponents by massive amounts. But every ad under California law had to have a legend on it that said, major funder, colon, Chevron, Inc. Once the major funder is identified, the voters are able to take that into consideration, and all of the candidates supported by Chevron went down to defeat. So while this concept is, I think, extremely well-intentioned, it definitely needs more work to avoid being just something that can be easily evaded.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle and members of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I might also add, as background, that I'm a former national board member of the League of Women Voters, and I also served on Secretary of State Bill Bradbury's campaign finance disclosure panel now about a decade ago that made proposals that resulted in what is now ORSTAR. Professionally, I'm a computer software engineer, and so understand computer systems like ORSTAR, and I believe since I was on the national board, I have a national perspective of campaign finance issues as well. The League of Women Voters is a 95-year-old grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League of Women Voters of the United States and the League of Women Voters of Oregon have studied campaign finance several times and fully support disclosure of campaign contributions and expenditures. The League of Women Voters Education Fund of Oregon is the charitable and education arm of the League, also publishes a voter's guide for at least all of Oregon's primary and general elections. We also sponsor from that education fund things like debates, forums, candidate fairs, the nationally award-winning mock election program, and we have a couple of websites, including voteoregon.org, and nationally a system called vote411.org. All of these are for the only purpose of informing voters of what their choices are when they do go to vote, and have no attempt at influencing the outcome one way or another. Our voters' guides, and in general, the League never supports or opposes any candidate or political party. However, separately from our voters' guides, the League does at times support or oppose ballot measures if our members have done an appropriate study and if we have a position on the subject.
Mr. Turrell, now you've submitted written testimony.
Yes.
So if there's something different than the written testimony that you'd like to testify to or highlight, that would be great. But we have the written testimony.
So I want to highlight the fact that this bill uses the word refers, that's rather vague. And I might try to answer Representative McLean's question from earlier about organizations that refer to candidates or ballot measures. That would trigger them being required to file as a political committee, I believe, and that might, if I understand the appropriate laws, cause them to disclose all their campaign, all their contributions, and all their expenditures, whether or not they're related to the trying to influence the campaign or not. The league is such an organization that does refer to candidates in all of our voter service activities, that the education fund does this, and we have been trying to work with the sponsors of this bill to work on an amendment. It's clear to me that that amendment has now failed to get support, but this is a very vague and flawed proposal that could have severe consequences in the law. And since it is so vague, it probably could be challenged in court on that process.
Mr. Turrell, did you express your concerns with Representative Davis or Nathanson before?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. So I would offer that you should continue to work with them to help them get to the transparency that they would like to see while addressing your concerns.
So I have outlined to legislative council and to the supporters, the sponsors of this bill, what we think needs to be done, and I put that in the testimony here that has to do with independent expenditures and how the disclosure of those could be beefed up so that people who are trying to influence the outcome of election would actually be required to give more disclosure, and we would get these shadowy super PACs and others that are trying to influence our elections to actually disclose.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Questions for this panel? No comments? All right. With that, Michael Slauson and Kimberly McCullough. Please identify yourself for the record. And as I said to the previous person, if you have written testimony that you've submitted, most of us have, if not, we will read it, and please highlight the points that you would like us to focus on. Who would like to start?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. My current assignment is special counsel on public safety. The department was asked to review various bills relating to regulation of political advertising and expenditures and to identify any constitutional hurdles related to those bills. We did that specifically with Senate Bill or House Bill 3397. We looked at it both in the Article 1, Section 8 of our Oregon Constitution, which regulates our free speech, and the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Typically, people think of Article 1, Section 8 as being more restrictive than the First Amendment, and that's generally true, but having worked on other legislation in the past, I know you need to get past both of those hurdles, and they're different. There's not just one that's always more restrictive than the other. And we know that generally under both of those, the provision of the state and federal constitution, the direct regulation of speech is prohibited. So bills that would be directed at that probably would be unconstitutional. This attacks a problem somewhat differently, like by requiring people to report certain expenditures. The main goal of that requirement is to educate the public on who is spending what money on what ads. The key goalpost here that we think makes this less risky on a constitutional level are the narrowing language that refers to expenditures that are only within 60 days and above $500. I should issue the disclaimer that when you're dealing with constitutional issues such as this, when we're talking about Article 1, Section 8 or the First Amendment, that it's a mitigating risk when you talk about challenges to these statutes. There's no way to eliminate the risk altogether, and there's not a lot of case law specifically on these types of expenditure regulations. So what I can say is that the narrowing helps. We can't say that there's no risk because here, if you do have even expenditure requirements that don't directly regulate speech, can place an undue burden on speech. And so again, that's what those limitations help to mitigate. I'd be happy to answer any questions if the committee has them.
Great. And yourself.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to start by saying that we do fully support disclosure, and in particular, we believe that there should be more disclosure in federal elections, and Oregon has very broad disclosure requirements, and we support them, and we would defend them. We have some concerns about this bill, and that's because some of the language is somewhat overbroad, and we believe it would be overbroad under both the Oregon and the federal constitution, because it would require disclosure in many circumstances where the speech at issue is not actually advocating for or against a candidate, measure, or party, and it will apply to non-campaign speech. I'd like to just direct your attention to a Ninth Circuit case. It's federal FEC versus Fergatch, 807 F2nd 857. And that case was looking at federal disclosure laws. It was looking at the FEC regulations related to disclosure. And what they articulated there, looking at those laws, was that there's essentially a reasonable person test when it relates to whether or not speech is advocating for or against a candidate, and that under constitutional law that we can require disclosure, but that the speech has to basically have a reasonable interpretation that it's an exhortation to vote for or against a specific candidate or measure. It needs to be unambiguous and suggestive of only one plausible meaning. It has to be a clear plea for action, and it has to be clear what it's advocating for. Now, they were really clear that there's no magic words, right? So, for example, if it uses the word elect, or it uses the word support, or it uses a candidate name, or it doesn't use those things, that doesn't mean that it's one thing or the other. The point is that you look at the language as a whole and you decide, does this actually urge you to support or oppose something? And so the problem here with this law is it just talks about referring to a candidate. And if you look at the two sections above the part that the amendment here, it already covers language that is, or expenditures that are made for the purpose of supporting or opposing a candidate. So Representative McLean brought up the example of an ad that says, you know, do this, and it's within a certain amount of time. That's already covered under our disclosure requirements. I'd like to give maybe a slightly different example, which would be, so for example, with the hunting publication, if there's a hunting publication and somebody spent a bunch of money on it and they just happened to mention in it that Representative McLean is a hunter, now that would be referring to a candidate. If it was within 60 days and it had nothing to do with the election at all, it would be covered by this. And so that's why we think this is terribly overbroad. It needs to actually be something that relates to the election and that is urging you to do something for or against a candidate or a measure. So this language is particularly problematic. That said, you know, we do support disclosure, so we would be delighted to be part of any ongoing conversation if there are gaps in what's covered under Oregon law. And you know, if that conversation relates to what the League of Women Voters are proposing, we'd be delighted to continue to talk to them as well.
So. Fantastic. Does anybody have any questions for this panel? Any comments? Great. With that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3397, and with no further business, we are adjourned.